started going through Mac's records and books. Intrusive as hell, I know, but I had to figure out what was going on before matters got worse. And that was when it hit me. Matters getting worse. I could see a mortal wizard, motivated by petty spite, greed, or some other mundane motivation, wrecking Mac's bar. People can be amazingly petty. But non-humans now. That was a different story. The fact that this Bassarid chick had a credit card meant she was methodical. I mean, you can't just conjure one out of thin air. She'd taken the time to create an identity for herself. That kind of forethought indicated a scheme, a plan, a goal. Untidying a Chicago bar, neutral ground or not, was not by any means the kind of goal that things from the Never Never set for themselves when they went undercover into mortal society. Something bigger was going on then. Mac's place must have been a side item for Bassarid. Or maybe a stepping stone. Mac was no wizard, but he was savvy. It would take more than cheap tricks to get to his beer with him here, and I was betting he had worked out more than one way to realize it if someone had intruded on his place when he was gone. So, if someone wanted to get to the beer, they'd need a distraction. Like maybe Kane. Kane made a deal with Bassarid, evidently. I assumed he gave her the bloodstone in exchange for being a pain to Mac. So she ruins Mac's day, gets the bloodstone in exchange, end of story. Nice and neat. Except that it didn't make a lot of sense. Bloodstone isn't exactly impossible to come by. Why would someone with serious magical juice do a favor for Kane to get some? Because maybe Kane was a stooge. A distraction for anyone trying to follow Bassarid's trail. What if Bassarid had picked someone who had a history with Mac, so that I could chase after him while she did whatever she planned to do with the rest of Mac's beer? Wherever the hell that was. It took me a half an hour to find anything in Mac's files. The first thing was a book, a really old book, bound in undyed leather. It was a journal, apparently, and written in some kind of cipher. Also interesting, but probably not germane. The second thing I found was a receipt for a whole hell of a lot of money, along with an itemized list of what had been sold. Beer, representing all of Mac's various heavenly brews. Someone at World Class Limited had paid him an awful lot of money for his current stock. I got on the phone and called Murphy. "Who bought the evil beer?" Murphy asked. "The beer isn't evil, it's a victim. And I don't recognize the name of the company. World Class Limited." Keys clicked in the background as Murphy hit the internet. "Caterers," Murphy said a moment later. "High end." I thought of the havoc that might be about to ensue at some wedding or bar mitzvah and shuddered. "Hell's bells," I breathed. "We've got to find out where they went."
"Egad, Holmes," Murphy said in the same tone I would have said, "duh."
"Yeah, sorry. What did you get on Bassarid?"
"Next to nothing," Murphy said. "It'll take me a few more hours to get the information behind her credit card."
"No time," I said. "She isn't worried about the cops. Whoever she is, she planned this whole thing to keep her tracks covered from the likes of me."
"Aren't we full of ourselves?" Murphy grumped. "Call you right back."
She did.
"The caterers aren't available," she said. "They're working the private boxes at the Bulls game."
I rushed to the United Center. Murphy could have blown the whistle and called in the artillery, but she hadn't. Uniformed cops already at the arena would have been the first to intervene, and if they did, they were likely to cross Bassarid. Whatever she was, she would be more than they could handle. She'd scamper, or worse, one of the cops could get killed. So Murphy and I both rushed to get there and find the bad guy before she could pull the trigger, so to speak, on the Chicago PD. It was half an hour before the game, and the streets were packed. I parked in front of a hydrant and ran half a mile to the United Center, where thousands of people were packing themselves into the building for the game. I picked up a ticket from a scalper for a ridiculous amount of money on the way, emptying my pockets, and earned about a million glares from Bulls fans as I juked and ducked through the crowd to get through the entrances as quickly as I possibly could. Once inside, I ran for the lowest level, the bottommost ring of concession stands and restrooms circling entrances to the arena, the most crowded level, currently, where the entrances to the most expensive ring of private boxes were. I started at the first box I came to, knocking on the locked doors.
No one answered at the first several, and at the next, the door was opened by a blonde who, in an expensive business outfit showing a lot of décolletage, had clearly been expecting someone else. "Who are you?" she stammered. I flashed her my laminated consultant's ID, too quickly to be seen.
"Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ma'am,"
I said in my official's voice, which was like my voice, only deeper and more pompous. I'd heard it from all kinds of government types.
"We've had a report of tainted beer. I need to check your bar, see if the bad batch is in there."
"Oh," she said, backing up, her body language immediately cooperative. I pegged her as somebody's receptionist, maybe. "Of course." I padded into the room and went to the bar, rifling bottles and opening cabinets, until I found 11 dark brown bottles with a simple cap with an M stamped into the metal, Max Mark. I turned to find the blonde, holding out the half-empty bottle number 12 in a shaking hand. Her eyes were a little wide.
Am I in trouble?
I might be. I took the beer bottle from her, moving gingerly, and set it down with the others. Have you been feeling, sick or anything? I asked as I edged toward the door, just in case she came at me with a baseball bat. She shook her head, breathing more heavily. Her manicured fingernails trailed along the V-neck of her blouse.
I mean, you know, her face flushed. Just looking forward to, the game.
Uh-huh, I said warily. Her eyes suddenly became warmer and very direct. I don't know what it was exactly, but she was suddenly filled with that energy women have that has nothing to do with magic and everything to do with creating it. The temperature in the room felt as if it went up about 10 degrees.
Maybe you should examine me, sir.
I suddenly had a very different idea of what Mac had been defending himself from with that baseball bat, and it had turned ugly on him. Hell's bells, I thought I knew what we were dealing with.
Fantastic idea, I told her. You stay right here and get comfortable. I'm going to grab something sweet. I'll be back in 2 shakes.
All right,
she cooed. Her suit jacket slid off her shoulders to the floor.
Don't be long.
I smiled at her in what I hoped was a suitably sultry fashion and backed out. Then I shut the door, checked its frame, and focused my will into the palm of my right hand. I directed my attention to one edge of the door and whispered, "Forzare." Metal squealed as the door bent in its frame. With any luck, it would take a couple of guys with crowbars an hour or two to get it open again, and hopefully Bubbles would pitch over into a stupor before she did herself any harm. It took me 3 more doors to find one of the staff of World Class Limited, a young man in dark slacks, a white shirt, and a black bow tie, who asked if he could help me. I flashed the ID again.
"We've received a report that a custom microbrew your company purchased for this event has been tainted. Chicago PD is on the way, but meanwhile I need your company to round up the bottles before anyone else gets poisoned drinking them."
The young man frowned.
"Isn't it the Bureau?"
"Excuse me?"
"You said Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. It's a Bureau."
Hell's bells, why did I get someone who could think now?
"Can I see that ID again?" he asked.
"Look, buddy," I said, "you've gotten a bad batch of beer. If you don't round it up, people are going to get sick, okay? The cops are on the way, but if people start guzzling it now, it isn't going to do anybody any good."
He frowned at me.
"Better safe than sorry, right?" I asked him.
Evidently, his ability to think did not extend to areas beyond asking stupid questions of well-meaning wizards.
"Look, really you should take this up with my boss."
"Then get me to him," I said. "Now." The caterer might have been uncertain, but he wasn't slow. We hurried through the growing crowds to one of the workrooms that his company was using as a staging area. A lot of people in white shirts were hurrying all over the place with carts and armloads of everything from crackers to cheese to bottles of wine, and a dozen of Mac's empty wooden boxes were stacked up to one side of the room. My guide led me to a harried-looking woman in catering wear who listened to him impatiently and cut him off halfway through.
I know, she snapped. "Look, I'll tell you what I told Sergeant Murphy.
A city health inspector is already here, and they're already checking things out, and I am not losing my contract with the arena over some pointless scare.
You already talked to Murphy? I said.
Maybe 5 minutes ago, sent her to a woman from the city over at Midcourt.
Tall woman? I asked, feeling my stomach drop. Blue, black hair, sort of busty.
Know her, do you? The head caterer shook her head. Look, I'm busy.
Yeah, I said. Thanks.
I ran back into the corridor and sprinted for the boxes at Midcourt, drawing out my blasting rod as I went and hoping I would be in time to do Murphy any good. A few years ago, I'd given Murphy a key to my apartment, in a sense. It was a small amulet that would let her pass the magical wards that defend the place. I hadn't bothered to tell her the thing had a second purpose. I wanted her to have one of my personal possessions, something I could, if necessary, use to find her if I needed to. She would have been insulted at the very idea. A quick stop into the men's room, a chalk circle on the floor, a muttered spell, and I was on her trail. I actually ran past the suite she was in before the spell let me know I had passed her, and I had to backtrack to the door. I debated blowing it off the hinges. There was something to be said for a shock and awe entrance. Of course, most of those things couldn't be said for doing it in the middle of a crowded arena that was growing more crowded by the second. I'd probably shatter the windows at the front of the suite, and that could be dangerous for the people sitting in the stands beneath them. I tried the door just for the hell of it, and it opened. Well, damn it. I much prefer making a dramatic entrance. I came in and found a plush-looking room, complete with dark, thick carpeting, leather sofas, a buffet bar, a wet bar, and two women making out on a leather love seat. They looked up as I shut the door behind me. Murphy's expression was, at best, vague, her eyes hazy, unfocused, the pupils dilated until you could hardly see any blue, and her lips were a little swollen with kissing. She saw me, and a slow and utterly sensuous smile spread over her mouth.
Harry, there you are.
The other woman gave me the same smile with a much more predatory edge. She had shoulder-length hair, so black it was highlighted with dark, shining blue. Her green-gold eyes were bright and intense, her mouth full. She was dressed in a gray business skirt suit, with the jacket off and her shirt mostly unbuttoned, if not quite indecent. She was otherwise, as Bert Decker had described her, statuesque and beautiful.
So, she said in a throaty, rich voice, this is Harry Dresden.
Yes, Murphy said, slurring the word drunkenly. Harry and his rod.
She let out a giggle. I mean, my God, she giggled.
I like his looks, the brunette said. Strong, intelligent.
Yeah, Murphy said. I've wanted him for the longest time,
she tittered.
Him and his rod.
I pointed said blasting rod at Metatrina Bassarid. What have you done to her?
I, the woman said, nothing.
Murphy's face flushed.
Yet.
The woman let out a smoky laugh, toying with Murphy's hair.
We're getting to that. I only share the embrace of the god with her, wizard.
I was going to kick your ass for that, Murphy said.
She looked around, and I noticed that a broken lamp lay on the floor, and the end table it had sat on had been knocked over, evidence of a struggle.
But I feel so good now.
Smoldering blue eyes found me.
Harry, come sit down with us.
You should, the woman murmured. We'll have a good time.
She produced a bottle of Max Ale from somewhere.
Come on, have a drink with us.
All I'd wanted was a beer, for Pete's sake. But this wasn't what I had in mind. It was just wrong. I told myself very firmly that it was wrong, even if Karen managed somehow to make her gun's shoulder rig look like lingerie. Or maybe that was me. Metatrina was a Roman goddess of wine, I said instead. And the Bassarids were another name for the handmaidens of Dionysus. I nodded at the beer in her hand and said, I thought Maenads were wine snobs. Her mouth spread into a wide, genuine-looking smile, and her teeth were very white.
Any spirit is the spirit of the god, mortal.
That's what the psychic conduit links them to, I said. To Dionysus, to the god of revels and ecstatic violence.
Of course, the Maenad said. Mortals have forgotten the true power of the god. The time has come to begin reminding them.
If you're gonna muck with the drinks, why not start with a big beer dispensary in the arena? You'd get it to a lot more people that way.
She sneered at me. Beer? Brewed in cauldrons the size of houses by machines and then served cold. It has no soul. It isn't worthy of the name.
Got it, I said. You're a beer snob.
She smiled, her gorgeous green eyes on mine. I needed something real, something a craftsman took loving pride in creating.
This actually made sense from a technical perspective. Magic is about a lot of things, and one of them is emotion. Once you begin to mass manufacture anything, by the very nature of the process, you lose the sense of personal attachment you might have to something made by hand. For the Maenad's purposes, it would have meant that the mass-produced beer had nothing she could sink her magical teeth into, no foundation upon which to lay her complex compulsion. Max Beer certainly qualified as being produced with pride. Real, personal pride, I mean, not official corporate spokesperson pride.
Why, I asked her, why do this at all? I am hardly alone in my actions, wizard, she responded, and it is who I am.
I frowned and tilted my head at her.
Mortals have forgotten the gods, she said, hints of anger creeping into her tone. They think the white god drove out the many gods, but they are here. We are here. I, too, was worshipped in my day, mortal man.
Maybe you didn't know this, I said, but most of us couldn't give a rat's ass. Raining down thunderbolts from on high isn't exclusive territory anymore.
She snarled, her eyes growing even brighter. Indeed. We withdrew and gave the world into your keeping. And what has become of it? In 2,000 years, you've poisoned and raped Mother Earth, who gave you life. You've cut down the forests, fouled the air, and darkened Apollo's chariot itself with the stench of your smithies.
And touching off a riot at a Bulls game is going to make some kind of point, I demanded.
She smiled, showing sharp canines. My sisters have been doing football matches on the continent for years. We're expanding the franchise.
She drank from the bottle, wrapping her lips around it and making sure I noticed.
Moderation. It's disgusting. We should have strangled Aristotle in his crib. Alcoholism. Calling the god a disease?
She bared her teeth at me.
A lesson must be taught.
Murphy shivered, and then her expression turned ugly, her blue eyes focusing on me.
Show your respect to the god, wizard, the Maenad spat. Drink. Or I will introduce you to Pentheus and Orpheus.
Greek guys, both of whom were torn to pieces by Maenads and their mortal female companions in orgies of ecstatic violence. Murphy was breathing heavily now, sweating, her cheeks flushed, her eyes burning with lust and rage, and she was staring right at me.
Oh boy. Make you a counteroffer, I said quietly. Break off the enchantment on the beer and get out of my town now, and I won't FedEx you back to the Aegean in a dozen pieces. If you will not honor the god in life, Metatrina said, then you will honor him in death.
She flung out a hand, and Murphy flew at me with a howl of primal fury. I ran away. Don't get me wrong. I've faced a lot of screaming, charging monsters in my day. Granted, not one of them was small and blonde and pretty for making out with what might have been a literal goddess. All the same, my options were limited. Murphy obviously wasn't in her right mind. I had my blasting rod ready to go, but I didn't want to kill her. I didn't want to go hand to hand with her either. Murphy was a dedicated martial artist, especially good at grappling, and if it came to a clinch, I wouldn't fare any better than Cain had. I flung myself back out of the room and into the corridor beyond before Murphy could catch me and twist my arm into some kind of Escher portrait. I heard glass breaking somewhere behind me.
Murphy came out hard on my heels, and I brought my shield bracelet up as I turned, trying to angle it so that it wouldn't hurt her. My shield flashed to blue-silver life as she closed on me, and she bounced off it as if it had been solid steel, stumbling to one side. Metatrina followed her, clutching a broken bottle, the whites of her eyes visible all the way around the bright green, an ecstatic and entirely creepy expression of joy lighting her face. She slashed at me, three quick, graceful motions, and I got out of the way of only one of them. Hot pain seared my chin and my right hand, and my blasting rod went flying off down the corridor, bouncing off people's legs. I'm not an expert like Murphy, but I've taken some classes, too, and more important, I've been in a bunch of scrapes in my life. In the literal school of hard knocks, you learn the ropes fast, and the lessons go bone deep. As I reeled from the blow, I turned my momentum into a spin and swept my leg through Mediterina's. Goddess or not, the Maenad didn't weigh half what I did, and her legs went out from under her. Murphy blindsided me with a kick that lit up my whole ribcage with pain, and she had seized an arm before I could fight through it. If it had been my right arm, I'm not sure what might have happened, but she grabbed my left, and I activated my shield bracelet, sheathing it in sheer kinetic power and forcing her hands away. I don't care how many Aikido lessons you've had. They don't train you for force fields. I reached out with my will and screamed, "Forzare!" Then I seized a large plastic waste bin with my power. With a flick of my hand, I flung it at Murphy. It struck her hard and knocked her off me. I backpedaled. Mediterina had regained her feet and was coming for me, bottle flickering. She drove me back into the beer stand counter across the hall, and I brought up my shield again just as her makeshift weapon came forward. Glass shattered against it, cutting her own hand. Always a risk with a bottle. But the force of the blow was sufficient to carry through the shield and slam my back against the counter. I bounced off some guy trying to carry beer in plastic cups and went down, soaked in brew. Murphy jumped on me then, pinning my left arm down as Mediterina started raking at my face with her nails, both of them screaming like banshees. I had to shut one eye when a sharp fingernail grazed it, but I saw my chance as Mediterina's hands, hot, horribly strong hands, closed over my throat. I choked out a gasp, "Forzare!" and reached out my right hand, snapping a slender chain that held up one end of a sign suspended above the beer stand behind me. A heavy wooden sign that read in large, cheerful letters, "Please drink responsibly," swung down in a ponderous, scything arc and struck Mediterina on the side of the head, hitting her like a giant's fist. Her nails left scarlet lines on my throat as she was torn off me. Murphy looked up, shocked, and I hauled with all my strength. I had to position her before she took up where Mediterina left off. I felt something wrench and give way as my thumb left its socket, and I howled in pain as the sign swung back, albeit with a lot less momentum now, and clouted Murphy on the noggin, too. Then a bunch of people jumped on us, and the cops came running. While they were arresting me, I managed to convince the cops that there was something bad in Mac's beer. They got with the caterers and rounded up the whole batch, apparently before more than a handful of people could drink any. There was some wild behavior, but no one else got hurt. None of which did me any good. After all, I was soaked in Budweiser and had assaulted two attractive women. I went to the drunk tank, which angered me mainly because I'd never gotten my freaking beer. And to add insult to injury, after paying exorbitant rates for a ticket, I hadn't gotten to see the game either. There's no freaking justice in this world. Murphy turned up in the morning to let me out. She had a black eye and a sign-shaped bruise across one cheekbone. "So, let me get this straight," Murphy said. "After we went to Left Hand Goods, we followed the trail to the Bulls game. Then we confronted this Maenad character, there was a struggle, and I got knocked out." "Yep," I said. There was really no point in telling it any other way. The nefarious hooch would have destroyed her memory of the evening. The truth would just bother her. Hell, it bothered me, on more levels than I wanted to think about. "Well, Basser had vanished from the hospital," Murphy said, "so she's not around to press charges. And given that you were working with me on an investigation, and because several people have reported side effects that sound a lot like they were drugged with Rohypnol or something,
And because it was you who got the cops to pull the rest of the bottles, I managed to get the felony charges dropped. You're still being cited for drunk and disorderly.
Yay, I said, without enthusiasm.
Could have been worse, Murphy said. She paused and studied me for a moment.
You look like hell.
Thanks, I said. She looked at me seriously, then she smiled, stood up on her tiptoes, and kissed my cheek.
You're a good man, Harry.
Come on, I'll give you a ride home.
I smiled all the way to her car.
Love Hurts, from Songs of Love and Death, edited by George R. R. Martin and Gardner Dozois, takes place between Turncoat and Changes. Gardner Dozois has a bunch of awards for his anthologies because he's good at them, and I leapt at his invitation to contribute to the anthology he was working on with George R. R. Martin, originally titled Star-Crossed Lovers. Despite my enthusiasm, finding a starting point for a Dresden story was sort of a puzzler for me, since Harry Dresden might be in the top three star-influence-free lovers in the whole contemporary fantasy genre. How was I going to bring him into a story with a theme like that? Answer, get him into the thick of things next to Murphy when seemingly random love spells are running amok through the city. After that, all I had to do was apply his usual streak of luck and cackle madly to myself while typing. The title of the anthology changed to Songs of Love and Death after I had written the story, which is probably a good thing. Otherwise, I may have tried to find a way to fit a death metal battle of the bands into the margin somewhere. No one deserves that.
Murphy gestured at the bodies and said, "Love hurts."
I ducked under the crime scene tape and entered the Wrigleyville apartment. The smell of blood and death was thick. It made gallows humor inevitable. Murphy stood there looking at me. She wasn't offering explanations. That meant she wanted an unbiased opinion from CPD's special investigations consultant, who is me, Harry Dresden. As far as I know, I am the only wizard on the planet earning a significant portion of his income working for a law enforcement agency. I stopped and looked around, taking inventory. Two bodies, naked, male and female, still intertwined in the act. One little pistol, illegal in Chicago, lying upon the limp fingers of the woman. Two gunshot wounds to the temples, one each. There were two overlapping fan-shaped splatters of blood, and more had soaked into the carpet. The bodies stank like hell. Some very unromantic things had happened to them after death. I walked a little farther into the room and looked around. Somewhere in the apartment, an old vinyl was playing Queen. Freddie wondered who wanted to live forever. As I listened, the song ended and began again a few seconds later, popping and scratching nostalgically. The walls were covered in photographs. I don't mean there were a lot of pictures on the wall, like at great-grandma's house. I mean covered in photographs. Entirely. Completely papered. I glanced up. So was the ceiling. I took a moment to walk slowly around, looking at pictures. All of them, every single one of them, featured the two dead people together, posed somewhere and looking deliriously happy. I walked and peered. Plenty of the pictures were near duplicates in most details, except that the subjects wore different sets of clothing, generally cutesy matching t-shirts. Most of the sites were tourist spots within Chicago. It was as if the couple had gone on the same vacation tour every day, over and over again, collecting the same general batch of pictures each time. "Matching t-shirts," I said. "Creepy." Murphy's smile was unpleasant. She was a tiny, compactly muscular woman with blonde hair and a button nose. I'd say she was so cute I just wanted to put her in my pocket, but if I tried to do it, she'd break my arm. Murph knows martial arts. She waited and said nothing. "Another suicide pact. That's the third one this month," I gestured at the pictures. "Though the others weren't quite so cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Or, in medias res." I shrugged and gestured at the obsessive photographs. "This is just crazy." Murphy lifted one pale eyebrow ever so slightly. "Remind me,
How much do we pay you to give us advice, Sherlock? I grimaced.
Yeah, I know. I was quiet for a while and then said, What were their names?
Greg and Cindy Bartolacci, Murphy said. Seemingly unconnected dead people, but they share similar patterns of death. Now we're upgrading to irrational and obsessive behavior as a precursor. I frowned. I checked several of the pictures and went over to eye the bodies.
Oh, I said.
Oh, hell's bells. Murphy arched an eyebrow.
No wedding rings anywhere, I said. No wedding pictures, and...
I finally found a framed family picture, which looked to have been there for a while among all the snapshots. Greg and Cindy were both in it, along with an older couple and a younger man.
Jesus, Murph, I said. They weren't a married couple. They were brother and sister.
Murphy eyed the intertwined bodies. There were no signs of struggle. Clothes, champagne flutes, and an empty bubbly bottle lay scattered.
Married? No, she said. Couple? Yes.
She was unruffled. She'd already worked that out for herself.
Ick, I said. But that explains it.
Explains what?
These two. They were together, and they went insane doing it.
This has the earmarks of someone tampering with their minds. Murphy squinted at me.
Why?
I spread my hands. Let's say Greg and Cindy bump into bad guy X. Bad guy X gets into their heads and makes them fall wildly in love and lust with each other. There's nothing they can do about the feelings, which seem perfectly natural. But on some level, they're aware that what they're doing is not what they want, and dementedly wrong, besides. Their compromised conscious minds clash with their subconscious, I gestured at the pictures, and it escalates until they can't handle it anymore, and bang. I shot Murphy with my thumb and forefinger.
If you're right, they aren't the deceased, Murphy said. They're the victims. Big difference. Which is it?
Wish I could say, I said. But the only evidence that could prove it one way or another is leaking out onto the floor. If we get a survivor, maybe I could take a peek and see, but barring that, we're stuck with legwork.
Murphy sighed and looked down.
Two suicide packs could technically be a coincidence. Three of them? No way it's natural. This feels more like something's M.O. Could it be another one of those Scavis vampires?
They gun for loners, I said, shaking my head. These deaths don't fit their profile.
So you're telling me we need to turn up a common denominator to link the victims?
Gosh, I wish I could have thought of that on my own.
I winced. Yeah. I glanced over at a couple of other SI detectives in the room, taking pictures of the bodies and documenting the walls and so on. Forensics wasn't on site. They don't like to waste their time on the suicides of the emotionally disturbed, regardless of how bizarre they might be. That was crap work, and as such, had been dutifully passed to SI. I lowered my voice.
If someone is playing mind games, the council might know something. I'll try to pick up the trail on that end. You start from here. Hopefully I'll earn my pay and we'll meet in the middle.
Right. Murphy stared at the bodies and her eyes were haunted. She knew what it was like to be the victim of mental manipulation. I didn't reach out to support her. She hated showing vulnerability, and I didn't want to point out to her that I'd noticed.
Freddy reached a crescendo that told us love must die. Murphy sighed and called,
For the love of God, someone turn off that damn record!
I'm sorry, Harry, Captain Lucio said. We don't exactly have orbital satellites for detecting black magic.
I waited for a second to be sure she was finished. The presence of so much magical talent on the far end of the call meant that at times the lag could stretch out between Chicago and Edinburgh, the headquarters of the White Council of Wizards. Anastasia Lucio, captain of the Wardens, my ex-girlfriend, had been readily forthcoming with the information the council had on any shenanigans going on in Chicago, which was exactly nothing.
Too bad we don't, eh? I asked.
Unofficially, is there anyone who might know anything?
The gatekeeper, perhaps. He has a gift for sensing problem areas, but no one has seen him for weeks, which is hardly unusual. And frankly, Warden Dresden, You're supposed to be the one giving us this kind of information. Her voice was half-teasing, half-deadly serious. What do you think is happening?
Three couples, apparently lovey-dovey as hell, have committed dual suicide in the past 2 weeks, I told her. The last two were brother and sister. There were some seriously irrational components to their behavior.
You suspect mental tampering, she said. Her voice was hard.
Lucio had been a victim, too. I found myself smiling somewhat bitterly at no one. She had been, among other things, mind-boinked into going out with me, which was apparently the only way anyone would date me lately.
It seems a reasonable suspicion. I'll let you know what I turn up.
Use caution, she said. Don't enter any suspect situation without backup on hand. There's too much chance that you could be compromised.
Compromised? I asked.
Of the two people having this conversation, which of them exposed the last guy rearranging people's heads?
Touché, Lucio said. But he got away with it because we were overconfident, so use caution anyway.
Planning on it, I said. There was a moment of awkward silence, and then Anastasia said,
How have you been, Harry?
Keeping busy, I said. She had already apologized to me, sort of, for abruptly walking out of my personal life. She'd never intended to be there in the first place. There had been a real emotional tsunami around the events of last year, and I wasn't the one who had gotten the most hurt by them. You?
Keeping busy?
She was quiet for a moment and then said,
I know it's over, but I'm glad for the time we had together. It made me happy. Sometimes I...
Miss feeling that, I thought, completing the sentence. My throat felt tight.
Nothing wrong with happy.
No, there isn't. When it's real.
Her voice softened.
Be careful, Harry. Please.
I will,
I said. I started combing the supernatural world for answers and got almost nothing. The little folk, who could usually be relied on to provide some kind of information, had nothing for me. Their memory for detail was very short, and the deaths had happened too long ago to get me anything but conflicting gibberish from them. I made several mental nighttime sweeps through the city using the scale model of Chicago in my basement, and got nothing but a headache for my trouble. I called around the Paranet, the organization of folk with only modest magical gifts, the kind who often found themselves being preyed upon by more powerful supernatural beings. They worked together now, sharing information, communicating successful techniques, and generally overcoming their lack of raw magical muscle with mutually supportive teamwork. They didn't have anything for me either. I hit McAnally's, a hub of the supernatural social scene, and asked a lot of questions. No one had any answers. Then I started contacting the people I knew in the scene, starting with the ones I thought most likely to provide information. I worked my way methodically down the list, crossing out names, until I got to ask random people on the street. There are days when I don't feel like much of a wizard, or an investigator, or a wizard investigator. Ordinary PIs have a lot of days like that, where they look and look and look for information and find nothing. I get fewer of those days than most, on account of the whole wizard thing giving me a lot more options. But sometimes I come up goose eggs anyway. I just hate doing it when lives may be in danger. 4 days later, all I knew was that nobody knew about any black magic happening in Chicago, and the only traces of it I did find were the minuscule amounts of residue left from black magic wrought by those without enough power to be a threat. Warden Ramirez had coined the phrase dim magic to describe that kind of petty, essentially harmless malice. There were also the usual traces of dim magic performed subconsciously from a bed of dark emotions, probably by someone who might not even know they had a gift. In other words, goose eggs. Fortunately, Murphy got the job done. Sometimes hard work is way better than magic. Murphy's Saturn had gotten a little blown up a couple of years back, sort of my fault, and what with her demotion and all, it would be a while before she'd be able to afford something besides her old Harley.
for some reason, she didn't want to take the motorcycle, so that left my car, the ever-trusty, almost always, Blue Beetle, an old-school VW bug that had seen me through one nasty scrape after another. More than once, it had been pounded badly, but always it had risen to do battle once more. If by battle one means driving somewhere at a sedate speed without much acceleration and only middling gas mileage. Don't start. It's paid for. I stopped outside Murphy's little white house with its little pink rose garden and rolled down the window on the passenger side. Make like the Duke's a hazard, I said. Door's stuck. Murphy gave me a narrow look. Then she tried the door. It opened easily. She slid into the passenger seat with a smug smile, closed the door, and didn't say anything. Police work has made you cynical, I said. If you want to ogle my butt, you'll just have to work for it, like everyone else, Harry. I snorted and put the car in gear. Where are we going? Nowhere until you buckle up, she said, putting her own seatbelt on. It's my car, I said. It's the law. You want to get cited? Because I can do that. I debated whether or not it was worth it while she gave me her cop look and produced a ballpoint pen. I buckled up. Murphy beamed at me. Springfield, head for I-55. I grunted. Kind of out of your jurisdiction. If we were investigating something, Murphy said, we're not. We're going to the fair. I eyed her sidelong. On a date? Sure, if someone asks, she said offhandedly. Then she froze for a second and added, it's a reasonable cover story. Right, I said. Her cheeks looked a little pink. Neither of us said anything for a little while. I merged onto the highway, always fun in the car, originally designed to rocket down the Autobahn at a blistering 100 kilometers an hour, and asked Murphy, Springfield? State Fair, she said. That was the common denominator. I frowned, going over the dates in my head. State Fair only runs, what, 10 days? Murphy nodded. They shut down tonight. But the first couple died 12 days ago. They were both volunteer staff for the fair, and they were down there on the ground setting up. Murphy lifted a foot to rest her heel on the edge of the passenger seat, frowning out the window. I found skee-ball tickets and one of those chintzy stuffed animals in the second couple's apartment. And the Bartolacci's got pulled over for speeding on I-55, 5 minutes out of Springfield, and bound for Chicago. So maybe they went to the fair, I said. Or maybe they were just taking a road trip or something. Murphy shrugged. Possibly, but if I assume that it's a coincidence, it doesn't get me anywhere, and we've got nothing. If I assume there's a connection, we've got a possible answer. I beamed at her. I thought you didn't like reading Parker. She eyed me. That doesn't mean his logic isn't sound. Oh, right. She exhaled heavily. It's the best I've got. I just hope that if I get you into the general area, you can pick up on whatever's going on. Yeah, I said, thinking of walls papered in photographs. Me too. The smells are what I enjoy the most about places like the State Fair. You get combinations of smells at such events like none found anywhere else. Popcorn, roast nuts, and fast food predominate, and you can get anything you want to clog your arteries or burn out your stomach lining. Chili dogs, funnel cakes, fried bread, majorly greasy pizza, candy apples, ye gods. Evil food smells amazing. Which is either proof that there is a Satan or some equivalent out there, or that the Almighty doesn't actually want everyone to eat organic tofu all the time. I can't decide. Other smells are a cross-section, depending on where you're standing. Disinfectant and filth walking by the porta-potties, exhaust and burned oil and sun-baked asphalt and gravel in the parking lots, sunlight on warm bodies, suntan lotion, cigarette smoke and beer near some of the attendees, the pungent, honest smell of livestock near the animal shows, stock contests, or pony rides, all of it charging right up your nose. I like indulging my sense of smell. Smell is the hardest sense to lie to. Murphy and I started in mid-morning and began walking around the fair in a methodical search pattern. It took us all day.
The state fair is not a rinky-dink event.
Damn it, she said. We've been here all day. You sure you haven't sniffed out anything?
Nothing like what we're looking for, I said. I was afraid of this.
Of what?
A lot of times magic like this, complex, long-lasting, subtle, dark, doesn't thrive well in sunlight. I glanced at the lengthening shadows. Give it another half hour and we'll try again. Murphy frowned at me.
I thought you always said magic isn't about good and evil.
Neither is sunshine. Murphy exhaled, her displeasure plain. You might have mentioned it to me before. No way to know until we tried, I said. Think of it this way. Maybe we're just looking in the exact wrong place. She sighed and squinted around at the nearby food trailers and concession stands.
Ugh. Think there's anything here that won't make me split my jeans at the seams?
I beamed. Probably not. How about dogs and a funnel cake?
Bastard, Murphy growled. Then, okay.
Halfway through my second hot dog, I realized we were being followed. I kept myself from reacting, took another bite, and said, maybe this is the place after all. Murphy had found a place selling turkey drumsticks. She had cut the meat from the bone and onto a paper plate, and she was eating it with a plastic fork. She didn't stop chewing or look up. What you got? Guy in a maroon tee and tan BDU pants, about 20 feet away off your right shoulder. I've seen him at least 2 other times today. Doesn't necessarily mean he's following us. He's been busy doing nothing in particular all 3 times. Murphy nodded. 5'8" or so, long hair, little sole tuft under his mouth?
Yeah.
He was sitting on a bench when I came out of the porta potty, Murphy said. Also doing nothing. She shrugged and went back to eating. How do you want to play it?
We're here with a zillion people, Harry.
She deepened her voice and blocked out any hint of a nasal tone.
You want I should whack him until he talks?
I grunted and finished my hot dog. Doesn't necessarily mean anything. Maybe he's got a crush on you. Murphy snorted.
Maybe he's got a crush on you.
I covered a respectable belch with my hand and reached for my funnel cake. Who could blame him? I took a bite and nodded. All right, we'll see what happens then. Murphy nodded and sipped at her Diet Coke. Will says you and Anastasia broke up a while back.
Will talks too much, I said darkly.
She glanced a little bit away.
He's your friend. He worries about you.
I studied her averted face for a moment and then nodded.
Well, I said, tell Will he doesn't need to worry.
It sucked. It sucks less now. I'll be fine. Fish in the sea, never meant to be, etc. I paused over another bite of funnel cake and asked, how's Kincaid?
The way he always is, Murphy said. You get to be a few centuries old, you get a little set in your ways.
She shook her head.
It's his type. He'd be that way if he were 20. He walks his own road and doesn't let anyone make him do differently, like...
She stopped before she could say who Kincaid was like. She ate her turkey leg. A shiver passed over the fair, a tactile sensation to my wizard senses. Sundown. Twilight would go on for a while yet, but the light left in the sky would no longer hold the creatures of the night at bay. Murphy glanced up at me, sensing the change in my level of tension. She finished off her drink while I stuffed the last of the funnel cake into my mouth, and we stood up together. The western sky was still a little bit orange when I finally sensed magic at work. We were near the carnival, a section of the fair full of garishly lit rides, heavily slanted games of chance, and chintzy attractions of every kind. It was full of screaming, excited little kids, parents with frayed patience, and fashion-enslaved teenagers. Music tinkled in brayed tinny tunes. Lights flashed and danced. Barkers bleated out cajolement, encouragement, and condolences in almost equal measures. We drifted through the merry chaos, our maroon-shirted tail following along 10 to 20 yards behind. I walked with my eyes half-closed, giving no more heed to my vision than a bloodhound on a trail. Murphy stayed beside me, her expression calm,
her blue eyes alert for physical danger. Then I felt it, a quiver in the air, no more noticeable than the fading hum from a gently plucked guitar string. I noted its direction and walked several more paces before checking again, in an attempt to triangulate the source of the disturbance. I got a rough fix on it in under a minute and realized I had stopped and was staring.
"Harry?"
Murphy asked.
"What is it?"
"Something down there," I said, nodding to the midway. "It's faint, but it's something." Murph inhaled sharply.
"This must be the place. There goes our tail."
We didn't have to communicate the decision to each other. If the tail belonged to whoever was behind this, we couldn't let him get away to give the culprit forewarning. And odds were excellent that the sudden rabbit impersonation by the man in maroon would result in his leading us somewhere interesting. We turned and gave pursuit. A foot race on open ground is one thing. Running through a crowded carnival is something else entirely. You can't sprint unless you want to wind up falling down a lot and attracting a lot of attention. You have to hurry along, hopping between clusters of people, never really getting the chance to pour on the gas. The danger in a chase like this isn't that the quarry will outrun you, but that you'll lose him in the crowd. I had a huge advantage. I'm freakishly tall. I could see over everyone and spot Mr. Maroon bobbing and weaving his way through the crowd. I took the lead, and Murphy followed. I got within a couple of long steps of Maroon, but was interdicted by a gaggle of seniors in Shriner's caps. He caught a break at the same time, a stretch of open ground beyond the Shriners, and by the time I got through, I saw Maroon handing tickets to a carny. He hopped up onto a platform, got into a little roller coaster-style car, and vanished into an attraction. "Damn it," Murphy said, panting. "What now?" Behind the attraction, advertised as the Tunnel of Terror, there was an empty space, the interior of a circle of several similar rides and games. There wouldn't be anyone to hide behind in there. "You take the back, I'll watch the front. Whoever spots him gives a shout." "Got it." Murphy hurried off around the Tunnel of Terror. She frowned at a little plastic barrier with an authorized personnel only notice on it, then calmly ignored it and went on over. "Anarchist," I muttered, and settled down to wait for Maroon to figure out he'd been treed. He didn't appear. The dingy little roller coaster car came wheezing slowly out of the opposite side of the platform, empty. The carny, an old fellow with a scruffy white beard, didn't notice. He was dozing in his chair. Murphy returned a few seconds later. "There are two doors on the back," she reported. "Both of them chained and locked from the outside. He didn't come out that way." I inhaled and nodded at the empty car. "Not here, either. Look, we can't just stand around. Maybe he's running through a tunnel or something. We've got to know if he's inside." "I'll go flush him out," she said. "You pick him up when he shows." "No way," I said. "We stay with our wing..." I glanced at Murphy. "Person." The power I sensed came from somewhere nearby. If we split up, we're about a million times more vulnerable to mental manipulation. And if this guy is more than he appears, neither of us wants to take him solo. She grimaced, nodded, and we started toward the Tunnel of Terror together. The old carny woke up as we came up the ramp, let out a wheezing cough, and pointed to a sign that required us to give him 3 tickets each for the ride. I hadn't bought any, and the ticket counter was more than far enough away for Maroon to scamper if we stopped to follow the rules.
"Sir," Murphy said, "a man we're looking for just went into your attraction, but he didn't come out again. We need to go in and look for him."
He blinked gummy eyes at Murphy and said,
"3 tickets.
"You don't understand," she said. "A fugitive may be hiding inside the Tunnel of Terror. We need to check and see if he's there."
The carny snorted.
3 tickets, missy, though it ain't the nicest room you two could rent."
Murphy's jaw muscles flexed. I stepped forward.
"Hey, man," I said. "Harry Dresden, P.I. If you wouldn't mind, all we need to do is get inside for 5 minutes.
He eyed me.
"P.I., huh?"
I produced my license and showed it to him. He eyed it, and then me.
"You don't look like no private investigator I ever saw. Where's your hat?"
"In the shop," I said. "Transmission gave out.
I winked at him and held up a folded 20 between my first and second finger.
5 minutes?
He yawned.
Nope, can't let nobody run around loose in there.
He reached out and took the 20.
Then again, what you and your lady friend mutually consent to do once you're inside ain't my affair.
He rose, pulled a lever, and gestured at the car.
Mount up, he leered, and keep your extremities inside the car at all times.
We got in, and I was nearly scalded by the steam coming out of Murphy's ears.
You just had to play along with that one.
We needed to get inside, I said. Just doing my job, Sergeant. She snorted. Hey, Murph, look, I said, holding up a strap of old, worn leather. Seat belts. She gave me a look that could have scoured steel, then, with a stubborn set of her jaw, secured the flimsy thing. Her expression dared me to object. I grinned and relaxed. It isn't easy to really get Murphy's goat and get away with it. On the other side of the platform, the carny pulled another lever, and a moment later, the little cart started rolling forward at the blazing speed of 1, maybe even 2 miles an hour. A dark curtain parted ahead of us, and we rolled into the tunnel of terror. Murphy promptly drew her gun. It was dark, but I heard the scratch of its barrel on plastic as she drew it from its holder. She snapped a small LED flashlight into its holder beneath the gun barrel and flicked it on. We were in a cramped little tunnel, every surface painted black, and there was absolutely nowhere for Maroon to be hiding. I shook out the charm bracelet on my left wrist, preparing defensive energies in case they were needed. Murph and I had been working together long enough to know our roles. If trouble came, I would defend us. Murphy and her Sig would reply. A door opened at the end of the little hallway, and we rolled forward into an open set, dressed to look like a rustic farmhouse, with a lot of subtle details meant to be scary. Severed fingers at the base of the chicken-chopping stump, just below the bloody axe, glowing eyes appearing in an upstairs window of the farmhouse, that kind of thing. There was no sign of Maroon, and precious little place for him to hide.
Better get that seatbelt off, I told her. We want to be able to move fast if it comes to that.
Yeah, she said, and reached down, just as something huge and terrifying dropped onto the car from the shadows above us, screaming. Adrenaline hit my system like a runaway bus, and I looked up to see a decidedly demonic scarecrow hanging a few feet above our heads, bouncing on its wires and playing a recording of cackling mad laughter.
Jesus Christ, Murphy breathed, lowering her gun. She was a little white around the eyes.
We looked at each other and both burst into high, nervous laughs.
Tunnel of terror, Murphy said. We are so cool.
Total badasses, I said, grinning. The car continued its slow grind forward, and Murphy unfastened the seatbelt. We moved into the next area, meant to be a zombie-infested hospital. It had a zombie mannequin, which burst out of a closet near the track, and plenty of gore. We got out of the car and scouted a couple of spots where he might have been, but wasn't. Then we hopped into the car again before it could leave the set. So it went. On through a ghoulish graveyard, a troglodyte-teeming cavern, and a literal Old West ghost town. We came up with nothing, but we moved well as a team, better than I could remember doing with anyone before. Everything felt as smooth and natural as if we'd been moving together our whole lives. We did it in total silence, too, divining what each other would do through pure instinct. Even great teams lose a game here or there, though. We came up with diddly and emerged from the tunnel of terror with neither Maroon nor any idea where he'd gone.
Hell's bells, I muttered.
This week has been an investigative suck-fest for me. Murphy tittered again.
You said suck.
I grinned at her and looked around. Well, I said, we don't know where Maroon went. If they hadn't made us already, they have now.
Can you pick up on the signal what's it again?
Energy signature, I said. Maybe. It's pretty vague, though. I'm not sure how much more precise I can get.
Let's find out, she said.
I nodded.
Right, then.
We started around the suspect
circle of attractions, moving slowly and trying to blend into the crowds. When a couple of rowdy kids went by, one chasing the other, I put an arm around her shoulders and drew her into the shelter of my body so she wouldn't get bowled over. She exhaled slowly and did not step away from me. My heart started beating faster. "Harry," she said quietly.
"Yeah?"
"You and me,"